Welcome to the Collections by Michelle Brown Show, a show about people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality as they create change. This episode is brought to you in partnership with the Center for Peace Counseling and Holistic Healing Services. Welcome to Collections by Michelle Brown. I'm your host, Michelle Brown. Each week, we'll be talking with people living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality and creating change. Growing up on Detroit's Northwest Side, C. Imani Williams loved learning about Black culture, books, cheerleading, softball, and was involved in other community-based activities. While living in Detroit, Imani was the first full-time employee of the Ruffella Center, where she ran the drop-in center and street outreach program. She was founder of PFLAG Family Reunion Detroit Chapter and served on the board of Black Pride Society for Detroit's Hotter Than July. Her background includes work in guidance, counseling, communications, journalism, and creative writing. She's written for several publications, including Michigan's Between the Lines newspaper and a weekly column, Queer Voices from an Urban Bush Sister, on Travel Pride. A creative determined to live her purpose as a healing artist, Imani has used a combination of holistic creative arts, including yoga, meditation, mindfulness, poetry, and jewelry to empower others in Michigan, California, Nevada, and beyond. Her work pays homage to the ancestors and elders who paved the way while she works towards a Black art-infused better tomorrow. Her Standing on United Love Soul project provides a safe space where community members can explore the issues of the day affecting Black communities. Imani presents on LGBTQ issues across the country at conferences, workshops, and other events. She's building a legacy to leave not just for her community, but for her children and grandchildren. Imani, welcome to Collections by Michelle Brown. How are you today?
Well, I am here with a friend who goes way back. C. Imani Williams. You know, it was funny, before we started doing this, Imani, we were talking about how far we went back into things that aren't here anymore, like the Detroit Women's Coffee House. And what a great place that was, you know?
Yes. Absolutely. You know? Mm-hmm.
And we were also talking about, I can recall meeting you there. I also remember meeting your daughters, and we didn't all meet together because it was like your daughters were part of this program, Detroit Summer, and they talked about their mother, but I knew you from the coffee house, and it wasn't until we did a thing at the coffee house and we let the young people come in and you were there and all of a sudden like the light bulb went in, like, you know, oh, mother.
Right.
Daughter,
right.
Mother. You know, and that was just like so amazing. And you are a part of, you know, you are a part of Detroit in so many ways. Being there at the coffee house, that was such a unique place because as a lesbian, that was a place where we could go, you know, outside of bars or wherever else. It was like a safe place. But then you had your daughters and you let them be involved in a program, which is relatively new, that was about building community. And that's a part of you.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the other part is like, you're still, you may have be out there, but you're still a Detroit person. You know, Detroit is at your heart. We did a podcast on BIPOC Queer Voices, and one of the things you did was a shout out to Detroit. What are some of your fondest memories of the city that you feel sort of helped form you being the woman that you are today?
Certainly, one of my most esteemed spiritual places, just to go in and collect my thoughts, is Belle Isle. Just going and sitting at the water, I have my favorite spot. I am a Northwest Detroit girl for life. As a matter of fact, I just got Detroit Girl for Life tees for my girls and I. Because I have to represent. I have to represent. I love my city. You can say anything you want to, but don't talk about Detroit. You know, I will let folks know, especially out here, you know, in Nevada, you know, in California. Yes, we wear Detroit very proudly, and I carry her on my heart every day. So Belle Isle would be a top spot. I would say wherever there is, like, good street art, you know, I love the Avenue of Fashion. I grew up in Northwest Detroit. I will say that, you know, again and again. And Livernois Avenue, the Avenue of Fashion, was known for and is coming back as what it was, which is a place for Black business to thrive. You know, we talk about community. Just being in, and overall, just my biggest thing about Detroit was growing up when I grew up in the 70s on Pinehurst and 7 Mile. Very special times. Community is like everything to me. And growing up right there during that time with the civic obligation recognized by parents in the community, we had the Northwest Detroit Cougars Little League Association, which is just in my blood. My mother was a coach, softball and cheerleading for a couple of decades. But having that type of community, which was founded by, rest in power, Mr. Petros, Mr. Irving Petros, who was during my tenure at Mumford High School, he was principal. But he was responsible for founding that organization with parents in the community. So he was able to look at and know at a very early age when kids were even coming, you know, in up through elementary school, and certainly by the time they got to middle school and were of football age, which starts about, you know, with people looking at where they're going to go to high school and that type of thing, he was able to identify young men in the neighborhood and make sure that they were part of that organization. And so that kept a lot of folks out of trouble is my point. I'm sure that was my mother's goal with me. She knew where I was, but she was right there.
Hey, that's how our mamas were, you know.
Right, right. So just that experience is like my best experience. I am so grateful, ever grateful, to being a 70s kid and having the Northwest Detroit experience of community. And that is why I fight so hard for folks who need to know that community exists for them, those who are told that, you know, they don't exist or they don't need to exist. So,
now, when last you were here, because you were here earlier this year, right?
Mm-hmm.
What did you notice that was different that kind of surprised you and that you missed seeing from back in the day?
The neighborhood, my old neighborhood looks so different. I have to shout out my sister Felicia Wilson right here. For whenever I come home, we connect and we usually go to the water. This last time we went to the Riverwalk. I had never been. We went to the Riverwalk, and then we decided we were hungry, and we were invited to a Juneteenth celebration, and we did that, and we stopped and got corned beef. I suggested this place where I grew up on Wyoming and Margarita and or Curtis. I think it's Curtis. And it just, the whole, you know, just the whole area just looks so different. It feels different. It feels different because it looks different. And, you know, it's still COVID, so it wasn't you know, a lot of people outside yet. You know, that it was June. I'm going home later this month, and, you know, we'll see. I'll be looking.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I thought of the Avenue of Fashion. And, you know, like you said, that was like where, you know, it was the Avenue of Fashion. And I had some friends who used to live here, and we went in, and we were driving down Livernois, and they were like, this is different. I'm going, oh, what do you mean it's different? And they were surprised at the level of gentrification. They had seen it down by what we used to call the Cass Corridor and go to the Dalley and everything. They had mm-hmm. seen how that area had changed. In fact, now that's from going from Cass Corridor to, I know one point it was the University District, now it's Midtown, to where, you know, there's no coffee house. There, the people who made it, the artists and things who used to be all down in that area are gone. And they had heard about that. But when we went down Livernois, they were like, wow. I mean, what's happening to Detroit? And I'm going like, well, you know, it's what's happening in many cities. And
right.
I mean, you know, and I don't know if you remember Marlon Brown. He and his partner, Danny Terrell, they live in Seattle now. And he
yes.
was like, he said the same thing that you did. He came back, he went to the neighborhood, and the neighborhood had changed. And now he was like, you know, we should have bought some of these houses up, you know, we should to keep that community. And he thought that was just like, in some ways that was, although he was happy to see Detroit blossoming, I guess, he was unhappy to see what he felt was a displacement of the Black community.
Again.
Yeah.
And, that gentrification is big, but where I went, they retained Black ownership, so I was happy to see that. You know, mm-hmm. but I do know that gentrification is an issue, an ongoing issue, because it displaces the citizens that are already there, ruthlessly so, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I remember, yeah. you know, like I said, you had your daughters, you raised them here. You passed, you know, you took that go west young woman. What have you enjoyed about being west? I know you were in California for a while before you ended in Vegas. What have you found that made you feel right at home, and what have you missed? I know you miss our winters.
yes, just a little bit. mm-hmm. Actually, when I first left, I went to Tucson, Arizona, and that was in January of 07. And during my first week there, they had a MLK Caesar Survive park outing. And I went, and there were so many beautiful Black and brown bodies. I was like, Tucson is going to be groovy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. No. At that time, 2007, I don't believe that the civil rights movement had taken place yet in Tucson. We know that Arizona was the last state in the union to adopt MLK Day as a national holiday, and they only did it then because they didn't want to lose out on Super Bowl money. So shame on me. I knew that before I went. And they did not prove me wrong. And so the running joke while I was there was brothers come to Arizona on vacation and they go home on probation. So, you know, you already know. And they did not let me down, but I did find some wonderful spots in that place. One is a sweat lodge, a real sweat lodge, and it's in a residential neighborhood, and they have a women's night one night, and then they have a co-ed night, and they have a men's night. So I went on women's night, and there's a pool and everything, and I learned that I was a little bit of a prude. So it's, you know, 95 degrees still at night. There's an outdoor shower. You can shower. You can get in the pool, and you can go sit, you know, in this beautiful, this little teeny tiny space that maybe holds about 7 or 8 people at top. And I said, I was going to keep my, I want to keep my suit on when I go in that little teepee. It was so freaking hot. I just remember stripping everything off. I said, oh, nobody touch me. I don't feel nobody's body sweat. And then I got home with my arthritic back. I slept like a baby. So that was one of my favorite spots. And I found out about that spot because I met a sister who had locks in line in a CVS in Tucson. And black people would not speak back to me. I didn't know what was wrong. And so I made an appointment with the president of the Black Chamber of Commerce to want to shop my resume. But really, I wanted to know what was wrong. Why is it that when I look at other black people, they turn away or look down or whatever? Is it my lot? You know, they were down my back. Mm-hmm. It was 2007. I thought, you know, yeah, I'm sure you've seen locks before. And he said, I'm going to be honest with you. He said a lot of people came here from Texas and never learned to lift their head up. So it's very cliquish. If you are, you know, you didn't roll from Texas and you're not part of that Texas crew, they're not going to mess with outsiders. And I said, this is shameful. What happened to the unity that I saw during the MLK park outing? I was so disappointed, and I started applying to graduate schools in California, like, right after that meeting. I knew I wanted to write deeper and further. I was still trying to figure a lot out, and an MFA in creative nonfiction sounded like a good route to go at a school steeped in social justice.
You know,
that is how I ended up from Arizona to California. Yeah.
You know, it's funny that the more, you know, we get into our community and we travel, there are things that are, you know, we aren't just like one size fits all, but there are cultural things that you'll see and you'll understand, like, why are these black people acting different? And they can tell those of us who are from somewhere else that, and to be, like you said, and in that moment, you were the other amongst your own community, because, you know, of that historical background.
I remember going to the LGBT center in Tucson, and the sister came in late, so that made two black women in this room with a whole bunch of other folks. Mm-hmm. And she listened to me talk for a little bit, and she said, ooh, Tucson going to eat your ass alive. And, you know, I said, again, all I can do is be me. Let me find out a better place other than this LGBT center. I needed their Wi-Fi really bad. I don't even know if Wi-Fi was a thing yet in 2007, but it was a big deal. I remember using their computer center for a few months waiting to get my internet hooked up at my apartment. So, but I understood that there was going to be some discourse between the LGBT center and I, just based on her comment. So I was like, wow. And so I contacted the local LGBT paper there, the Tucson Weekly, and I wrote with Jimmy for about a year and a half. Pretty much what I wanted to write on my experience as a black lesbian in Tucson, Arizona.
Wow. So you started immediately starting to look to get to California. What was that like, night and day, going from Tucson to California?
Yes and no. It was a busy time. I was adjusting to a lot. I was going through a divorce. And soon after I got there, my mother got sick. So California was a different time. But I thank God for my Long Beach, Los Angeles, black lesbian community. I really do. They saved my life, honestly. And then there have been two different occasions. One, I was hosting a chat, a peer-to-peer chat group at the Long Beach Gay and Lesbian Center, and tying it into a practicum I had to do as part of my graduate program at NAIOC, The Writing Thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Iyutunde walks in. Only I didn't know her as Iyutunde. I knew her as Latrice, who co-founded Spice back home in Detroit.
Uh-huh.
And so that is where we first met in person. And I tell you, there's a whole Detroit community in Los Angeles and the Long Beach area. There really is. And she is one of them. The other person... And my roommate, who just passed, transitioned from this plane in May, connected all of us. But she insists I go to this black lesbian retreat up in Northern California, hosted by the Nia Collective, which has been put on a retreat for 30 years. And my former roommate, Sherry Dowd, was trying to save it when they said, we need some younger sisters to take this helm over. We're tired. We've been doing this for 30 years.
Uh-huh.
Come on, queer baby. Step up, ladies. But I go to this retreat, and comes back with Kofi. And so we're all in the same cabin for the weekend. There is something about black women who are brought here to connect other black women, and I know you understand that as a sister, queen, storyteller, story writer, poet, creative. I know this. And so though I only went like to the near retreat once, there was so much elder wisdom, black women, lesbian, butch, femme. I'm old school. I am not going to give you the whole rest of that alphabet. I can't even do it. My granddaughter has to keep me up to speed, and I'm slowly catching up. But I'm not going to add all the rest of it. But there was so much good woman energy in their space and their stories and most of them had been coming to Nia, you know, the 30 years that we had been in existence, and there was a ceremony to honor the elders, and that is something I would like to see in Detroit. I'm working on so much with my current project because it will involve my grandchildren. My two oldest are going on the payroll in 2022. They are. They mm-hmm. write. They are wonderful on the computer. Let's put this creativity to work. Because they're gonna have scholarships from the black queer community. I worked too hard. You know, you was on board with me. Those were volunteer positions.
Yeah.
So I'm about building the legacy that you spoke of at the beginning. Legacy. I've had so much, been stripped of so much because of my identity as a queer Black womanist, as someone who speaks her mind, as someone who believes that the quietest of us deserves a voice, deserves to have their story told, deserves to tell their story. And I'm just, I do curse, and I'm just sick of the bullshit. I just am. It is time for us to re-embrace the meaning of community. I recall being in a workshop in New Orleans. The LGBT group organization SMAC, if you recall them, Sexual Minority Alliance of Alameda County. They had a conference, and they brought a whole bunch of kids from California to New Orleans. And one of the workshops that I was in, called into, was on community. And I recall the president and the founder of that organization, SMAC, saying, I don't care if we stay in here 5 damn hours. It is this is a privilege. If you have a safe space to come, is a privilege. This is an honor.
Uh-huh.
And you have to understand that the bullshit has to stop. Like, that is your sister. That is your brother. As a Black gay man, you know how hard it is out here. Why would you treat her any less? Why would you do that? Why are you calling her, you have a mama, don't you? So much learning, yes, thank you. So much learning went, and he meant it. We stayed sequestered in that room until they understood, God help anybody that was lying and still didn't understand what it meant to have community. Because if you've been out there on the streets homeless, if you've been in a home where you're unsafe, it's not cool for you to go to sleep at night, you're on pins and needles. If you've had those situations, then you know how to treat people a little better.
Mm-hmm. And that some of this stuff, we have to collect these stories, we have to talk about it, because some of it is still going on. And if we don't talk about it, I was telling somebody once how I had gone up to Ruth Ellis Center, and there was a young trans woman, and she said, I was just like blown away. She said, until she actually got involved in the program, she thought that was just the name of a building. And it was after she got there, then she saw the video about Ruth Ellis, that this was a real person, and she suddenly felt a charge to continue to do things. And, just recently I was, on Facebook, and I saw Atiba, and she's retiring, and I don't know where it is. And it was like, and I mentioned it to somebody, and they were like, now, didn't he used to do something? And I'm like, didn't he used to do something? So we have a lot of people.
I hope he's painting. I hope he's working on his art. I hope he's a beautiful artist. He needs that. The last time I spoke with him, it's been years ago. I saw him I was home, and I saw him down at the Eastern Market. He was working for Avalon. That's the last time I saw him, and I asked him again. I said, Atiba, what you doing with your art, bruh? And he gave me another excuse. He is such a talented artist. I wish he would let himself be free, because he has. He's gifted in so many ways. I love Atiba. He gave me my name for Urban Bush Sister. He gave me a list of names, and Urban Bush Sister was the one I chose. love Atiba.
This is our history, and especially, like I said, when you go down to certain parts, and it has changed so much, and first of all, particularly for young people to know, like, you're not all brand new. Some of the stuff we've been working on, but maybe for all of us to come together and to find a solution. Because some people,
right.
I mean, I was talking to someone there, and they were saying, like, after the last 4 years, someone said, oh, we need to go back in the closet. So, no, you can't go back in the closet. People need to know that not only are we here, we've been here, we're going to continue to be here. The coffee house is gone. Let's talk about this. Where is a place where we can go? I mean, I've met so many entertainers who I've seen other cities, you know, and who are doing it. You know, we have legendary people. I was in Atlanta, walked into a conference, who was there? Kofi. I mean, you know, we have to collect stories because this is our history, and this is who we are, and we need to learn from that, and there's strength in that. And you know what? And more importantly, is to give people their roses while they're here.
Right. You know, as much as I love my city, I may ruffle some feathers, but I don't give a damn. I'm really over the corruption, the level, the amount that seem to have a need for corruption that takes away from resources that community, in particular, the youth, need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, growing up on the northwest side of Detroit, one of my favorite things to do on Saturday, going back to your earlier question, was to ride the Hamilton bus to Northland Mall spend the whole day, ups and downs, Bakers, Winkleman's, 579, just hanging. I had a friend that worked, you know, at the popcorn place. I had Otto's. Oh, my God. I had another friend that worked at the little place that had the little miniature chocolate chip cookies. So, you know, just going and just, it was a place you could go and you could hang out. This was before the 1981, the curfew that came right after 1981.
Mm-hmm.
It was a place for teenagers to go, you know, and then now there's not even a Northland Mall. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
you know, Belle Isle, you can't just roll up on Belle Isle. Now, you know, it's a state-owned park, so now you have to pay, have an annual sticker. You're not coming on Belle Isle for free. So that's another part of gentrification. It takes away from... It takes away from the art of just having a place to clear your head and think, you know? And that is why I am such an advocate for mental health awareness, particularly in Black communities. I was talking a minute about corruption and you know, how we have to do better. And it seems fitting, because I remember when Kwame Kilpatrick said, you know, in a meeting in a room I was in, I don't know if you were in that same meeting, where he said if one of his son's teachers was gay, he would remove his child. I've never forgotten that because, you know, and look at him and look at him now, and we know as queer Black women that the city of Detroit will welcome him back as they're doing. He ain't a stupid man. He knows that if he is at a 401c3 church, that he ain't got to pay regular taxes on that. So that's free money, all the gifts that his silver-lined tongue is able to prefer will do so, and women will be swiping those ATM cards because we are forgiving like that for everybody, usually except for our queer-ass kids.
Mm-hmm.
And on that note, because you mentioned Danny Terrell, I love him as one of my first employees when I was the director over at the Ruth Ellis Center. we were talking, and I said, with what you're doing with your artwork, with your art, with dance, with mental health, how you are connecting Black men to take a look and learn how to breathe and just be for a minute. We don't know how to be quiet anymore. I would like, I said, I'm assembling a group to, and I've been in touch with PFLAG for about a year, going back and forth in emails, and finally saying they are ready to talk to us about restarting a Detroit chapter. So over a course of several meetings, there were six of us. Over a course of six meetings, they hemmed and hawed. They didn't allow us to make any public announcement. And finally, maybe on meeting number five or six, they said, yeah, we have to really take it slow because whoever was last in charge of PFLAG Family Union did not do right. And they were investigated by the IRS. They hadn't paid their taxes. It's a big mess. We have to move really slow. So long story short, they are... It'll probably be a cold day in hell when Detroit proper sees another chapter again. Who loses the fuck out? The youth of Detroit. And I'm just so tired of it. It breaks my heart. It is not on one or two organizations. People hit things differently. When, you know, many, many, many moons ago when PFLAG Family Reunion was founded. Our biggest need was some grandmothers who were parenting, reparenting. They were parenting grandchildren who were coming out as transsexual. They had no idea what to do with that.
This episode of Collections by Michelle Brown is brought to you in partnership with the Center for Peace Counseling and Holistic Healing Services, bringing balance to your mind, body, and spirit. For more information or to schedule an appointment, visit the center at www.thecenterforpeacellc.com.
We're back here on Collections by Michelle Brown, and I'm talking with C. Imani Williams. You know, there has been, as Black people, as Black queer people, we have historical trauma. And you have, in many ways, gotten involved with wellness, Wellness Light, your wellness life coach, meditation, holistic creative arts, and often it's through those ways that we can deal with some of this trauma. And you also talk about, you know, that's one of the things that you talk about is trauma.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see how, and even healing from childhood trauma, how important is it? And do you see people taking a moment to acknowledge the trauma that you see? I mean, you know, because whenever you hear about somebody who's LGBTQ, particularly if it's a trans woman of color, whenever you, or someone Black being killed, it might not be someone who you know directly, but as you have to watch that every day and see it, it's very traumatic. And we have to heal.
Mm-hmm.
How did you,
mm-hmm.
How is your work affecting that, and how are you addressing that in your work?
I am always concerned about anyone that is marginalized.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So your work in wellness and addressing trauma, when did you find that, you know, that this is what you knew you had to bring to the table?
I've always known it. And I would say a very defining moment, though, was the probate case that I went through after my mother's transition.
Mm-hmm.
I only have one sibling. She is an attorney, a family law attorney, and an MBA accountant. And she absolutely relieved me, my girls, and my grandchildren of what my mother left here for us, because I am gay. You know, I hired a gay attorney. I believe that a person has to be vetted on whether or not, or their level of outness. I don't believe she was out. My sister was a pit bull, and that woman did not help me one iota. So I feel some kind of way about that, and legacy does matter. So, the book, the short story is titled Legacy of a Love Betrayed. My mother deserved better than what my sister has done. And so that's been a big defining moment of, one, coming forth so that people understand if there is someone gay in the family and there is resistance, or they are not loved, or they don't feel loved, and they are talked about, shunned, shamed, and they do nothing about it at all, or they just ignore it altogether. That is not what family is about. That is not what love is supposed to be about. And this shame on you, get your life together, really. There has to be a space for people to hear other people say, you know, so they can just hear a varied opinion. I'm not even asking you to agree 100%, but I am asking you to show that person, you know, respect. Don't invite them to Thanksgiving and then talk about them. You know, and if that's what's going to go down, then the community has to have some safe spaces. I know when I was in Detroit, Kofi made sure that we had something going for that college age position of population down at Wayne State University. I can't think of the name of the group right now. Can you?
Was it Caribou House, or was it Audre Lorde?
Yeah, no.
House?
It was a bi-weekly rap group. It was open to anybody from the black gay community. Lesbian, trans, gay, male, wherever you were on the variant, so that there would be a spot, so that people didn't feel like they needed to end up in Palmer Park twirling, and you know, scamming people for cash. It's too much going on. We gotta have some conversations. And it's ugly, and it has to do, I think, a lot with the fact that as black people, we've never had a total village conversation since slavery. We have not. And so much has gotten, you know, lost over time, or we continue to just hand trauma down generationally, because we've never taken the time to talk about it. It's painful as hell. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is trauma filled. I encourage anybody that has not read, you know, Black Slave Syndrome, please check it out. It is real deal. Epigenetics are real. We carry this trauma in our cells, in our DNA. And if we don't break cycles, it will continue generation after generation after generation. And I say this as an addict of much, and I say this as a survivor of much.
Mm.
You know, you got to take time for mental health. You know, I think about the number of people who've gotten together since the COVID pandemic started. You know, they thought they were in love in January, and by March 1st, they were quarantined with this person.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you move really, really fast, at least in my experience, if you move really, 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 really fast, you might find yourself in a bad situation. So now they, you know, are quarantined, and folks that, you know, their mask is starting to come off, they're starting to show some true colors, and it's not looking as sweet. But now you got this person moved up in your house with you and your kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And we don't even talk about the domestic violence between Black queer women. We don't.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. And I hear, you know, too often about, you know, folks having guns pulled on them and put in their mouth, and, you know, if you ever leave me, if I see you with that B again, and so that's some real damn dysfunction. So I'm talking to queer women, I am talking to straight women, I am talking to my trans sisters, who I assume follow the Black male, what used to be protocol. I don't know if that's changed, but I understood from, you know, Black gay men that in order to vie for who was the top and the bottom in the relationship,
mm-hmm.
that was, you know, it was handled with physical fighting. Well, you're not going to beat my ass and then turn around and tell me you want me and you love me.
Thank you.
No,
mm-hmm.
we're not going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm talking to them, too. So I want to touch folks in that 19 to 37-year-old target population, be they male-identifying, female, gay, or somewhere on the binary. I don't care. But I've grown tired of going to funerals.
Mm-hmm.
I've walked out of funerals because that beautiful trans sister laying in the jar got dressed up like a dude. Would not stand for this, so I'm gonna leave.
You know, the other thing that you talked about, you know, which we don't, because I mean, I know what you went through with your mother. I know my last sibling of my parents when she died. That's how they were. And, you know, some people would just, you know, forget them. You got your chosen family. But there's that level of hurt, you know, to have, to be cut off, to be treated that way and to not. And sometimes just walking away doesn't do it. And what you do is you hold that hurt. You take it into your relationships. Your kids see it. They suffer for it. But, you know, I mean, it's like, we have to stop to do it. And sometimes, like you said, you'll go to what you think are the arms of safety and hopefully this love that you were cut out from. And you, like you said, they want to do the, even like the fight or who's the top, who's, you know, and it's not right. I mean, when we still have mm-hmm. people, we have elders, I mean, and I'm, who have gone, and I can't think, there's somebody who was here, and they said that because she had no family, when she ended up in a nursing home, and she identified more on the masculine spectrum, and they said, and there she was in a dress. She had nobody to stand for her.
Right.
You know?
Right. And that's not right. That's not okay.
Mm-hmm.
People deserve better. And if their blood family is mm-hmm. unable to do it, then community better be there. They better be there. You know, my late dad, my beautiful and brilliant cool cat, we did not see eye to eye on my gayness at all. And I remember when I came out to him, I was like begging for confirmation. And he was a Libra. And he said, "Baby, you just shared some news that, you know, he had really gotten from my ex-husband that I should not have married. I should have taken time to get to know me and who I was." Mm-hmm. And this feeling of a great affinity towards women. That was just, I said, "Woo!" You know, I did my thing, and then I promptly stuck my toe back in the closet. So actually, my ex-husband on his exit outed me to my dad, and when he asked me if it was true, I told him yes. And I needed him to understand that in this moment, I am fighting for my life. I believe in a domestic violence, you know, situation that I got to come to grips with it. And I'm just coming into this thing that I got to see what that's about. Because at the end of the day, I have to be true to me. He wasn't the answer. He wasn't the answer. But my dad said, "You know, baby, you know, you're asking me to answer something really big, really deep, and you got to give me a minute to think about it." Well, that's a typical Libra answer. He had to balance the scales. I got that. But he did, in trying to better understand me, when our sister Elizabeth Liz Marshall left this planet to escape pain, he attended her memorial. He did come. And I thank him for that. And I say all of that to say that we owe it to family members, and I'm talking to straight folk. You owe it, you do, to at least try to understand. Because 9 times out of 10, your information is misinformed.
Mm-hmm.
You're getting it from porn. Please stop.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, you're getting it from TV.
Pick up a
no,
book,
we're not all
bruh.
Funny. You know,
you're getting it from mass media. You're getting it from the entertainment business. You're getting it from Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's too much. I am a Detroit girl for life. I keeps it real. My sister right here, Michelle Brown, keeps it real. So, you know, you really owe it to yourselves to get to know us or someone like us as you get to know your queer family member as a person and not a fucking stereotype. There.
Mm-hmm.
Small curtsy. Big curtsy. Yes. Yes, I mean that.
Mm-hmm.
You're missing out. You get that boy you teasing. You better let him do what he do with those scissors and that hair.
Mm-hmm.
Let him do his thing. Kids are coming out younger, and elementary school is no longer unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't believe that anyone chooses to be gay, because I do believe this is a hard. And it doesn't have to be this hard. Like, how dare you freaking judge me and you don't know me? But I don't believe that anyone chooses a lifestyle where people just hate you on speculation. That's some ignorant stuff.
Oh, I like that. You can hate me. I like that. You know, it's like, yeah.
You know, and, you know, part of my addiction and recovery is coming through sex addiction. I had to look at myself. So I am in my 11th year of celibacy. And so for those, you know, straight folk who equate being queer with being some sex freak, let me let you know I'm as far on the other end of the spectrum as one can get. And it has nothing to do with what one may think of me. It has everything to do with what I think of myself. And so that is part of healing, part of holistic self-care, self-love. Sometimes you got to stop, pump the brakes. And that goes for whomever is just out here.
Mm-hmm. Oh, when you look at you, you love you. I mean, and you are happy. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're living, I mean, you're a Renaissance woman. I mean, I was looking at your webpage, you know, and I knew some of the things you did, but I said, wow, you know, it's like you didn't get stuck in a box like, okay, I'm going to go and just be this or do that. You are exploring everything about you and all that you can be. How did you come up with Standing on United Love Soul Project? I love that.
Thank you. Well, Standing on United Love Soul Project is my baby. She is a culmination of this journey that I've been on for about the last 15 years, attending Antioch University's creative nonfiction writing program was life-changing. I was told that it is very rare that you have a student for their final project have something that they were writing on that they were going through currently, but I was, and it was a testament of writing, doing what it do, you know, once again, which has saved my life. My goodness, it has sustained me on this healing journey. I started out a crybaby. I haven't been able to physically cry in about 8 years. And so I am in need of that release. So the Soul Project healing work is as much as for clients as it is for me. I need to be able to cry. So, you know, there's so 11th year of celibacy, 17th year of no alcohol consumption. I am absolutely 420 friendly, though. I believe in the power of the plant, and I am a testament of being able to put down 11 post-hysterectomy scripts with cannabis and CBD. I didn't like how those pills made me feel, and between an arthritic back and an annular tear that is only going to get worse, I do what I do holistically to keep off of a walking cane I was on for 7 years. It's been in the closet for about for years now. And I want to keep it that way as long as possible.
You know, and that's just so like holistically. And, you know, and there are things that if you even look like ancestrally that we used and using all kinds of herbs, all types of holistic treatments, using cannabis, I mean, there and CBD, there have been things that we have used and been healthy to where now, I mean, how many people do you know when you go and you talk to them, they've got this laundry list of pills, and sometimes even if you go into Western doctors, they see you and they see you as black, female, and even of a certain age, and they're ready to get off the script and start writing this stuff for you without knowing you and your body.
Right. Well, we do, each of us, have a absolute personal responsibility to be our own best patient advocate. And by that I mean, if it doesn't sound right to us, to question that. And if need be, to get a second opinion. I saw a lot of disrespect as a patient in California, and it was absolutely counter to my experience in Tucson, Arizona, which was very, very much life-changing with a hysterectomy where they punctured my they punctured something needed, my bladder. Mm-hmm. And all I can say was I was treated with kid gloves there, despite that little bit of that bad experience. I had an overall positive experience with my both my general practitioner and with my GM. With the general practitioner, I told him, you know, your population is clearly changing. I'm here. Yet there's nowhere on this form for me to fill out at that time my spouse's name and the fact that I'm a lesbian. So you need to update this shit.
Mm-hmm.
He said he went home. He said, I went home on my next visit. He told me, he said, I went home and I talked with my feminist wife and daughter, and they absolutely agree with you. So the next batch, you'll be all right with that. I said, well, thank you so much. So, and I think it's important that, again, that each of us, you know, do that. You know, those that love you in this world are going to love you. Those that don't, you know, you can't worry about that. That's my philosophy. Mm-hmm. You know, I hope to have community. So my community might not be for everybody, because I'm definitely for the underdog that has this fire that has to burn. It has to. They got to do this thing. And this is a good time for us as Black people to really be proactive about mentorship. Seriously.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and to share those stories, because like what you just talked about, I was in Atlanta a couple years ago, pre-COVID. At the Zami Nobla conference, and they had a brunch where they were talking about healthcare, and there were still lesbians who were like intimidated by the healthcare system. We're seeing those forms that weren't acknowledging that, and there were some who felt uncomfortable, you know, to go and say, by the way, and you know, I'm gay,
right,
and you need to put my partner on there. And, you know, and it's like, oh, I just don't want to have to come out yet again. But you have to. Now, it's not just for yourself, you know, for the next
right
patient that comes in and they do it. And I was telling somebody, I said, you know, you pay for your medical insurance. You've got a copay. If I went in a store and they disrespected me and I didn't feel I could tell them what I needed, I'd go somewhere else. You know,
right.
So if your doctor doesn't want to hear it and doesn't want to do it, take your card and go down and find someone who will do. But we have to, like you said, advocate for ourselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have to do so without shame, and we have to know that we have a right to demand certain things. I'm paying you.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody paying you attached to my Social Security number. If you want to bring that up, you know, you're getting paid.
Mm-hmm.
So please, you know, treat me like a person. And I had to call a doctor out in California, in Glendale, California, about, you know, this very thing. Turned his back on me and walked away. I had asked for an MRI, and I asked for a mild sedative so I could fly.
Mm-hmm.
He said no to both. So I kindly went home and wrote an email to his boss, who I saw on the next visit, who apologized for this gentleman. It's okay. You know, yeah, I just needed to be acknowledged here. And he also wrote that prescription for two little things so I could fly. One on the way there and one on the way back. Mm-hmm. Thank you, sir. That's it. You know, and we have to be okay with pulling up our panties and our pants, our big girl ones and big boy ones, and doing it, just speaking up for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of people that still don't want to see us here. I think we've talked about everything except Vegas, which has
we're gonna get to that, and we'll go get to that. We got time for it now.
Okay.
Because you know, one of the things I talk about is how we stand in the intersection. Okay, not only are we queer or lesbian women, but you and I both are parents or mothers. You had daughters. You've got granddaughters. Okay, how important was it to you to stand in this truth, not just, you know, as a lesbian, but as this woman who goes to a healthcare provider? Because we know Black women in general don't get the level of healthcare as, you know, others
right.
do. So how important was you to stand in this truth as a Black woman, as this mother, for that, so that they see, hey, this is how you do it?
Extremely important. Again, you know, you named a lot of things a lot of perils within the healthcare system here in the U.S. and how that pertains to Black women and how we are portrayed, again, by the media and the stereotypes that precede us before we even, you know, hit down the doctor's office door. Sometimes they've already, you know, made an opinion of you. In particular, I noticed this, of course, more so on the West Coast in California, where there should be a lot more unity between Black and brown women. There's a lot of work to do there. They seem to have fallen into believing the stereotypes that are out there about us. So, you know, I have my Detroit face. You know, I have to put that on a lot of times when I was in California. Because you're invisible to so much of the populace. You're certainly invisible to Black men. As a Black woman, I've read at least three books. One written or penned by one of my schoolmates about that experience she's from the East Coast, and experience of invisibility in Los Angeles as a Black woman. It's real. It is so real. But you know, that was Long Beach was the place where I had my womanness and my sexuality stripped away, as I was asked not to return to a childhood sexual assault recovery group. It was such a horrible experience. I wrote about it. I was interviewed by the Long Beach Press, which went ahead and canceled it. I said, well, if you don't want to take my word for what happened, I'm a Black queer woman who was just put out of a recovery childhood sexual group when I came out. And the only reason I came out, because I just couldn't take it anymore. I had to sat there 5 weeks previous. I understood that the founder was older. She founded that program when she was 80. What I didn't know is that she had a deep hatred for gay people. She apparently had some horrible experiences, satanic, you know, at the hands of her mother. So she hated anything gay. But every week I listened to the gentleman who was the only other Black person in the room. He was older than me. His shoulders were slumped over. He just wore shame like a badge, and he was really struggling with his feelings of being gay. And so on my share, on meeting number 5, I said, you know,
you know, because I couldn't address it to him. That was against the rules. So to the center of the room, I said, you know, it is okay if you are gay. You are loved. I love you. And you have nothing to be ashamed about. And after that meeting, which was on a Sunday, I was working on a grant for the California Sexual Assault, something, this big thing they do in L.A. every year. And my phone rings, and it is the president of this group, the founder, the 80-year-old, along with her male vice president. And they did on a three-way call, and they said, you know what you did. You can't come back. I said, what are you talking about? They said, you know who you are, and you know what you do, and you know what you did. And they hung up. And if I had not been secure in my sexuality, I would have gotten off that phone and committed suicide, because who walks into, you don't walk into a sexual assault group because it's the place to be. You at a low-ass point in life.
How dare they?
So I wrote about it on the now defunct Skirt magazine. I don't know if you remember that, skirt.com. I wrote about it wherever I could. I really did. I was so upset. And so we absolutely must use our voice. I don't care if four people read it. If they read it and passed it on to somebody else, thank you. You know what I mean? I needed to let that out, because if I don't have some type of passage, since I can't cry and I'm not fucking, I'm not having sex, excuse me, I'm not making love, all that. You know, I worked on, it took me a minute to write erotic poetry. I ain't doing a deed. I'm not doing any of that. I have to have a release, and it comes through writing. It comes through writing. I can cuss a motherfucker out in five different languages in writing, and that feels pretty good. That feels like a woo-sah. And so as part of a wellness life coaching, and using as many holistic practices as possible, I hope to accomplish a few things. One, like I said, is adding the two oldest grandchildren to payroll in 2022. I also want to have programming specifically for black boys by themselves, and then specifically for black girls by themselves. I may not be the best person to run that part, but I want to have something to do with writing that program for rites of passage programming that I believe is missing within the black community, period.
Okay. Well, let's take a break, and then we're going to talk about Las Vegas, okay?
Collections by Michelle Brown airs every Thursday at 7 p.m. You can subscribe now and listen to the podcast on Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud. Be sure to like the Collections by Michelle Brown Facebook page and mark your calendar so you never miss an episode.
Back here on Collections by Michelle Brown with my sister C. Imani Williams. And so now, everything that happens in Vegas, is it staying in Vegas?
You know, actually, I am trying to create a Detroit Vegas hotline as a newly minted wedding officiant here.
I've counted
so many people that have come from Detroit since I've been here. And I just celebrated my fifth anniversary on the 1st of July. So 5 years, and people have come, and I And I always, you know, make time to see folks, and we grab a picture, and usually something to eat, and it's always good to see people from home. So, no, it's not staying in Vegas. I'm trying to spread it out, make sure that I'm connecting more people. I'm a little jealous of my friends that are here from L.A., that already had family here from Texas. It's pretty tight. And there's even a Facebook group, the Shy in Vegas. The Shy in Vegas. Mm-hmm. We need a Detroit in Vegas group.
Well, count me in. Because
this is such a different place. It really is. Mm-hmm. With folks from all over. It's the most transient place I've ever lived. It is absolutely the hottest place I've ever lived. I really miss the water. I miss the Pacific Ocean. I miss Belle Isle. California is, you know, like where I am, it's about a 4-hour drive to L.A. I don't get there often enough. I'm in Detroit more than I'm in Cali. It's been an interesting transition, and I think the poetry community, I think the Black arts community here is real tight, it's real. The pandemic slowed things down a bit, a lot. I'm waiting the reopening of Soul Sessions. Shout out to them over there. Like the most welcoming people in Vegas. Soul Sessions, Sticks and Stones, Poetry, Rail, where I was able to feature and talk, just minister to brothers a little bit about, you know, feeling safe and expressing love and that's all right. And checking on your mental health, that's all right. And it's okay to say no. And if you can't say no, bro, it's okay to use a condom. Absolutely, please.
Mm-hmm.
This is another thing we didn't talk about a lot with COVID. I didn't hear a lot about the AIDS pandemic that continues to do its thing. I didn't hear as much about that as I've heard about what people should be injecting into their bodies or not injecting into their bodies right now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and there's something wrong with that because we know disproportionately who will continue to catch hell on that. So we still need to continue to have that safer sex conversation as these COVID babies get ready to turn one.
Well, you know, I think that was what's so cool about doing that BIPOC Queer Voices was looking at it and to find, and I knew exactly that Tim M. West was going to talk about being positive because, I mean, and there are people who don't talk about it. I mean, you don't see as much, although now I think you see more commercials than you used to, but there are people are living longer. Positive, but there's still a lot of young people who are living a risky life. And, you know, just because there's a shot that you can take, that doesn't mean that you need to do better. And we know Black and brown people are at the bottom of the list.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
I hope that the parties have stopped, you know, hope the parties have stopped where folks who are intentionally going to these parties and hooking up with people who were infected so that they could get supposed public benefits. Let's not do that. We are brilliant. We are beautiful. We are alive. We are here, and we can all make a difference. And they got to know that. They got to see that. They got to see that because there's some garbage out here. As an author, I can say that, and I don't know how you feel about it, but I just, come on, people, at least put some thought into it. Put some thought into it, because people are reading this and they're making baseline assumptions on every gay person they come across based on this bullshit that you wrote. Stop it. Now, that might even identify a few, but don't. don't categorize everybody with that same broad brush. We are as different as we are politically black, as we are consciously black. We are different. And we gotta work on those intersections and bridging those gaps. We got to.
Mm-hmm.
We owe it to the babies.
And supporting those who want to tell a story, because I know I was in, it was at DC Pride at an author's forum, and a young guy, you know, because I was talking about writing poetry and this and that and the other thing, and he said, well, really, if he wanted to make a living, he needed to write basically black gay exploitation stories. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, is that how you really live your life? He said, well, no, but if I want to sell, I said, but, you know, to the message that you're giving to the young guy who might pick up your book and think, well, this is the life. It's not the life. Tell your story, your true story.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right now he decided to give out to the, you know, give in to the dollar. And mm-hmm. again, so I spoke of consciousness. He ain't there yet. So therefore, you know, he's one of them others that he can't represent me. I want, and I have three grandsons right now. So I had to do a lot of readjusting on my take on the black male. Mm-hmm. I really did. I keep it real. And then as a grandmother to not only them, but to granddaughters. And I want this world to be a better place for them. I am dismayed about a lot that I see, but I have to live my name, which means faith. I have to live that believing that I'm equipping them with what I know, in creating a legacy so that they can carry forth. I could have done a lot of things with a master's in counseling that I held way before going to California. I had it since 1990. I could have done a lot of things with it, but I chose community. And while community has not always loved me back, I am here for my grandbabies, and I absolutely, you know, don't intend to die in the desert. I doubt very seriously whether I will marry again. I'm just not interested after three. I marry people. I am not the marrying one. I don't have that kind of time. After one has been, you know, suffered a great loss financially that would have provided a different lifestyle, perhaps. At least the struggle wouldn't have been as hard mm-hmm. as it has been, but I am thankful for the journey. I am stronger. I am better. I am wiser. I am here. And my voice, man, God said now is the time, in answer to your earlier question about standing on United Love Soul Project, God said this is absolutely the time. You will put together that MFA in writing with that MA in counseling, and you will change community. You will be a change agent. That's it.
You know, we started out talking about, you know, like us and your daughters in Detroit Summer. And someone often tells me, I always go back to that Jimmy Boggs would always say, and when in doubt, I always go back to that. He would always say, what can we be that our children might see? And that's what you just said. I mean, you are, like you said, you could have gone this way and that way, but you're building a better world for your children, for your grandchildren, for their children. And that's your focus.
That's it. That's it. I have learned through all of this that, you know, people are going to be who they are unless they are willing to change. So that 19 to 37-year-old target group of black women is my first. And if I can help others along the way, I will do that. You know, I want to absolutely, we'll be ready next summer with a yoga program for kids. My 2-year-old has done yoga with me. The 4-year-old, we've done some things. And the 11-year-old just finished a technology camp in Southfield. And part of their curriculum during this last week was to do yoga in the park. And my daughter was just telling me how powerful the picture of all those black boys walking with those yoga mats under their arms, chilled. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That was beautiful. I had to make a picture in my mind. And I just thought they need that. That meant they got to let down that bravado. I got to be tough. I got to be, you know. No, you don't. No, you don't. You get to be you. Just relax. Breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And our kids need that. And mm-hmm. Yes. And our girls need that. It is hard being a black girl anywhere. As long as men are protected as a rape and pillage and do what they do. And they don't get, you know, the book thrown at them or, you know, at least some street justice.
Mm-hmm.
I'm serious. Mm-hmm. I am over it. Like who hashtag who's looking out for Keisha?
Mm-hmm.
Seriously.
And
every girl has a story.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And they still and media does things that sort of make it where they can go out with that same crappy dialogue like, well, you know, somehow or other that boys will be boys and girls who are asking for it. And that's just
they have to know about autonomy over their bodies, you know. I'm
mm-hmm.
in Vegas. This is a hub for sex trafficking. You know, my daughter 16 years ago was working at Home for Alternatives for Girls, and she was almost snatched off the corner of Michigan and wherever they're located now, their new building. They've been there about 20 years.
Yeah, I know exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, then they're near the Boulevard.
Not Michigan and Trumbull. That's the old one. Yeah.
Yeah, but
yeah.
Now. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
And she was almost grabbed by two women in a car. The only reason she got away, she said, was because that big girl that looked like a man did not have a weapon. The driver got scared and said, who she said was Puerto Rican, and said, come on, dog, let's go.
Mm.
So
wow.
That was 16 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had a student, I went to do a workshop at AFG on for women who were looking to get out of the sex business, and they were at different levels of leaving. Some had already left their pimp, some were trying to leave, some were had left and come back, but my heart stopped because one of my former babies from area high school was there, and when I heard Miss Amani in that little voice, I was like, what are you doing here? And she had gotten caught up in a ring that was going from Detroit, Chicago, and Ohio, and they got ring got busted when they stopped in Highland Park at the strip mall on Woodward, the Foot Locker, and her family said, you can't come home because you a hoe now.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Mm-hmm.
We have so much trauma to heal from, period. And that is why I am charged, I do believe, to do what I'm doing. And I just want to see us do better, have better, be better, and not drop the ball because the babies deserve better.
They
deserve a legacy, too.
Mm-hmm.
They deserve a legacy, too. And, you know, I was on Facebook earlier for a minute, and I saw one of my babies from Northwestern post her new house in Royal Oak, and I am so just proud and happy for her because she's like the same age as my kids, and she's, you know, she very supported by family, very driven, and just a reminder to any and everybody out there that, you know, you can do it too. You can do it too. Get out your own way. Get out your own way. You know? And if you're gonna stay in Detroit, you gotta do what you can to make Detroit better. Shout out to the North End, doing so much right now.
So much.
North End was a respite for me, and I came home for a year after my mom passed. I was home from October of 2012, and then I went back to Cali October of 2013. But during that year, I was in Detroit with a very dear sister friend who opened her doors and said, come and heal, because when I needed to come to Cali, you opened yours. And community. Mm-hmm. And so I learned about the North End. I learned about the rich history. I learned about these elders that were living on these blocks without lighting. And then I watched community come together and just keep going down to the city council and saying, damn it, we need lighting over here. It is not safe. This grass is high. There's no lights. Cut the grass. We pay city taxes in Detroit. And so it's being celebrated right now with the Oakland Gardens, where, you know, I've had the pleasure of shopping for fruits and vegetables and seeing stuff being planted and seeing it come up and seeing all the talent in the community. And, you know, for our area to be labeled, you know, all over the media and on YouTube as just blight field, which it was, and it did need the attention. But shout out to those residents who have stayed and those new folks that are coming in that are doing the work to make it a better place.
And during COVID, and I've been working with some people bringing out grants, that community from providing food, from caring for each other, like, shoot, they're doing, the North End is doing what community is about. And it makes you feel so proud.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so I want to urge people, you know, get over there and see the art exhibits, see all the beautiful street art, see what's going on in the neighborhoods, because, you know, Detroit cannot just be ever just downtown to midtown. There are neighborhoods, there are people, there are families, there are folks rooted who have stayed when others like myself needed a reprieve, but I'm coming back. And when I come back, one of my goals with the Soul Project is to open a heritage house, which existed when I was a kid in Detroit, over on Warren, West Warren, right by Wayne State. And it was run by this beautiful elder named Dr. Josephine Love, rest in power. I was able, while I was subbing at Northwestern High School, take my fashion students to meet her. And we had to have a conversation before that field trip, and that was, you keep your elbows in your laps. Do not go on her. We had to go old school with it, and here's why. Because she was about legacy. Like, her mother was a graduate of Spelman College back in the day when many black women were doing that hard, backbreaking domestic work. Her mom was a Spelman. She was an accomplished, you know, pianist. And what she had done in the city of Detroit was create a cultural space for black youth. Now, this was not a place like the Northwest Detroit Cougars for me. I only remember going one summer and maybe like four or five times, but it was fascinating. And so I had to get back to see her as an adult and to make sure that I took some other black kids with me so that they would understand that this place, because this lady was in her 90s. She was like 90 at this time. And so they needed to hear this knowledge from this elder and be blessed to get it from her directly. So I want to do something like the Heritage House, and that will include the yoga, the meditation, the mindfulness. It will give kids an opportunity to breathe. I'm going to look at, you know, holistic arts. We also will have the rites of passage programming, because in Africa, our kids, well, black kids, African kids, get rites of passage. Mm-hmm. For girls, you know, they go away with the elder women in the village for like 6 weeks, and when they come back, they're honored with cowrie shells. That might be a cowrie shell necklace or a cowrie shell ring or a pair of cowrie shell earrings, but it means that she is now a woman at 12 mm-hmm. or 13. But she's gotten some skills on, you know, keeping house and keeping herself clean and just honoring who she is and who she is becoming as a woman. And we, as black people, don't have that. The Latina girls get the quinceañeras.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do. They do.
You know, mm-hmm. you know, the Jewish girls get the bar mitzvahs. Everybody got something but us. And with the decline in the Y teen programs of yesterday through the YWCA, or with the restrictions that they're placed under, I don't know, are they gay friendly now? I used to work for the Y. I don't know.
Well, I know for the longest they weren't, you know. In fact, that's why I sort of lost base touch with them, because it was like, you know, I just wasn't feeling that.
Check with, for Detroit history on that, check with Dr. Kofi. She has some YWCA ties. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I worked there in the 90s, and there was no programming on the books, and I was the youth teen coordinator. But it was very, very, very interesting leadership. That's the other thing. I'm gonna need black leadership to take it to another level with reaching young people. Yeah, I'm missing the mark, particularly if you are now second generation cross 8 Mile. Mm-hmm. Some of you have changed. I am not. If you give back and you go back to your hood where you grew up, and you know the kids can count on Mr. Johnson on Saturdays where y'all, you know, raking the community garden, great. But if you don't take your kids there, I got a problem with that. I have a problem mm-hmm. with you. If you are not doing what you can in honor of where you came from, because we all stand on the backs of somebody else, let me tell you, that good-ass paying job could disappear tomorrow. Matter of fact, mm-hmm. you could get hit mm-hmm. by a car and be a paraplegic and not be able to do what they're paying you that big money mm-hmm. for no more.
Mm-hmm.
It's about legacy. It's about pride in where you came from. And I hate black respectability politics, so you'll never hear me talk that, but do have some self-love and some self-pride and feel some kind of way good about, you know, where you come from. And if you mm-hmm. think real hard, you know that there was somebody queer, not only in your family growing up, but somebody on your block, too. Think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because really, I mean, those are, you know, they talk about representation, but representation about people who are there. And anybody, I mean, if you start, I was having a conversation, like I said, just recently, and they said, well, what made you think about this? And I could remember when my mother would go to vote and she would take us, and the ladies who would always be at the table, and it mattered, you know. And I said, that's why I try to go to vote, because maybe one of these kids will see, here are these adults coming in here and you do that. Or my godmother who went beyond a block club to trying to do things and helping her pass out flyers because it mattered to her what happened to a community. So we, like you said, we need to go back, show up. It will we're paying it forward, but we're also lifting up our kids, you know, and showing them how magnificent we are. You know, all the stuff that they've seen, and unfortunately there were generations where they saw not the best images, but this is the real. This is who we are, and this is the real, you know. So, well, we're almost come to the end of our time here, but I have to say, when you said that you had been on a cane, girl, I've seen those TikTok things where you're dancing, and it's like so joyful. But you're
Thank you.
And you're smiling. I mean, I'm going like, and you, and I said, and, I, and I'm thinking about that. And then you, and she said she was on a cane. So, I mean.
Yeah, when the grandbaby started coming, I threw the cane down behind the dresser, and I said, I'm not having this. And I've been blessed, and I've been off of it. And, you know, I know one day, because I got, like I said, I got this issue with my hip and my back. So, but not today. Not today.
Well, Imani, it has been wonderful talking to you. When you come back this way, you know, hit me up so I know. We'll talk about more of this in person, okay?
Sounds good. Thank you so much for allowing me to share and to share some really precious memories. I tell you, just because our history is so deep, it evokes so many stories. And I do look forward to collaborating on something with you in the very near future. I really do.
Well, we will. I mean, because
I want to thank my guest, poet, activist, entrepreneur, and the original Urban Bush sister, Imani Williams, a creative determined to live her purpose as a healing artist through her Standing On United Love Soul project. Imani has used a combination of holistic creative arts, including yoga, meditation, mindfulness, poetry, essays, and jewelry design to empower others. Be sure and follow Collections by Michelle Brown Blog Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And let us know if you have a suggestion for a guest or a topic for a future show. You can listen to this or past episodes of the show on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, or Blog Talk Radio. Join us next week when I'll introduce you to another amazing individual living between the lines, standing boldly in the crosshairs of their intersectionality and creating change right here on Collections by Michelle Brown. Thank you for listening.